RNZ National, and it's time for our weekly segments on New Zealand's screen history. And today we go back to 1977 for the birth of a new show that would become one of the longest running and most popular local TV shows in New Zealand. See if this jogs your memory.
We start this week with a little amateur dramatics from 1982. It was illustrating how difficult it was to open those newfangled screw tops on soft drinks.
Yeah, it's the famous Fair Go theme. We're talking Fair Go this week, a show which was devised by Brian Edwards with producer Peter Moritz. A show that used investigative reporting to expose rip-offs and scams and help everyday people get a fair go. And with me today to look back on the early days of the show is its first presenter and creator, Brian Edwards, who's with me in the Auckland studio. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, lovely to have you in. And in Wellington, former host of the show, Kevin Milne. Hello.
Hello. Oh, gosh, what a thrill for me it is to be in the studio again with Brian. You know, I got into Fair Go, and people said, well, it's already been going about 6 years. It's a bit silly to join at this stage, or we can. And I said, well, if I've only got 1 year left in the show, and it's a year with Brian Edwards, then that would do me absolutely fine.
Sorry, excuse me, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
Someone pass me a bucket, please.
It's a lovely compliment, and it sounds...
It is a lovely compliment.
Authentic compliment, too. So there was some crossover between the two of you.
Just the 1 year, Brian couldn't stand it any longer. Besides, he was giving up smoking, I remember, that year.
Oh, no, that was a very dangerous year for everybody in that case, I could have thought, yes.
Yeah. Take us back to 1977, Brian. Do you recall coming up with the idea for the show?
Yes, I think to some extent it wasn't entirely my own idea. There was a program on the BBC called That's Life, and it was hosted by a fantastic interviewer, a woman called Esther Ranson. And I think there was a lot of inspiration for me from that program. And I'd always wanted to be kind of famous a little bit. And this seemed like quite a nice way to do it. And there were various segments in the Esther Ranson program, and one particular segment was on consumers. And I think that was the germ of the idea of that we could do a program in New Zealand where we could look at protecting people out there in the sort of normal in their normal daily lives from rip-offs and scams by various people. And it just soared from the beginning. I mean, it was tremendous. I mean, my playing a part of it and the other members of the team who were on there playing an enormous part of that, because their main function was to go out and get the stories. Mm. And I suppose my main function was to grill the villains. Because I'm a really quite unpleasant person, this fitted my personality very well. So I think that's more or less how we got started.
Yeah. And I imagine there was a bit of a David and Goliath theme there as well, standing up for the little guy.
Oh, yes, there would have been a theme like that. But my background is very much a working-class background, and so I didn't see myself as being any different from the little guy. I'd got a bit bigger thanks to the media. But I think it was very important to hold on to that concept. The aim of the program was to help people. The aim of the program was to defend people against the actions of unscrupulous people in business and other areas. And so it was an extraordinarily rewarding program to work on. One of my joys, because Judy would tell you I'm a quite a vain person, was just going for walks around town. Because you would just be stopped. I mean, and that was the popularity of the program, not particularly me, but you'd just be stopped all the way down. And that was absolutely lovely. People saying, loved your program last night, get those bastards, all that sort of thing.
And one of the things that I sort of realized later on, you know, once I was sort of inside the system,
yes,
was that there was proper investigative journalism. It wasn't a light show, although there were light moments, but the serious stuff you took seriously.
The serious stuff we took seriously. And of course, we had wonderful researchers working on the program. And that is the key to that, I think, really. Because you may end up with quite a lazy broadcaster, speaking of myself. And so we had some fantastic researchers. And so it was almost handed to you on a plate. Not quite, but it was almost handed to you on a plate.
Because if you're going to go hard at someone, you better get it right.
You bloody well better get it right, yes.
Kevin Milne, anything you'd like to add as far as the premise of the show goes and maybe what's created some of that magic?
It was beautifully set up, really, and it didn't require any changes much, and still hasn't, you know, 44 years later. Mm-hmm. I remember that there was a good deal of cynicism in the early days from the newsroom journalists who thought that because there was an element of entertainment on the show that you couldn't call it real journalism, which was nonsense because it ended up leading the way in terms of investigative journalism.
They sort of talk about hybrid news entertainment shows as if they're something that people invented in the late 20-teens, right?
Yes.
But Fair Go was the original. It was doing both and slipping pretty easily from one to the other.
Brian was responsible for most of that and keeping a good balance on the two, which is important. You couldn't have the funny, silly stuff on the show unless the show had kicked off with a damn strong story, or else people would just say it was lightweight.
Yeah, I think we approached it with in mind a degree of entertainment. I mean, it was meant to be a serious current affairs program or investigative program, but we tried to have bits in it or keep it reasonably light as well. And I think that helped a lot.
I think you had a bit of a food metaphor, Kevin. Do you recall that?
Yes, it was. I said in my book actually that it was like a good meal. Really, you had the main course, which was pretty solid, and then you'd work through to the sweets at the end. And people watched the program for different reasons. I'm sure a lot of people in the end would just turn on to the second half, where we had all the fun. But you couldn't do that unless it was really solid. I remember there was a classic, an absolute classic in the year that I worked with Brian, where the guy that we were doing the story for couldn't get down to Wellington to appear live on the show. The show was live back in those days. And there was a weather problem. So Brian knew the story so well that he actually did both the interview and the answers on behalf of the Santorini Christmas Costume Company.
Wow.
And he did it perfectly. Of course, our lawyers were very nervous that he was going to somehow or another accidentally misrepresent the other side. But he knew their story so well, and it was just classic. Nobody had ever seen anybody interview themselves on television prior to that time.
I couldn't get enough of it. I didn't want to have guests at all, as you remember. I didn't want to have other people on the program, probably also remember. But there you are. You have to compromise, don't you, in these matters.
You mentioned nervous lawyers. I imagine you got used to nervous lawyers running a show like this inside a big network.
Well, probably to some extent, but that's their job. And you're being protected by that. So I think it's very important to accept that. And I don't think that really bothered me very much. And I think that not very long after the program, we developed a trust in other people and who knew that we weren't going to be madly irresponsible. We weren't going to say dreadful things. We weren't going to defame people left, right, and center. And we weren't going to be unreasonably horrible to people. And so I think we had a set of, not written down actually, but a set of premises about the general tone of the thing. The program was meant to be entertaining, it was meant to be fun, and it was meant to get the bad guys.
It's hard to believe now that back then, at the time when Brian set up those programs, most broadcasters never named names. And
right.
I can remember now hearing news stories which would say a well-known department store in Lambton Quay appeared in court this morning. No mention. And when Fair Go started up, it was decided it would name names. And that was what got the lawyers and the company, NZBC or whoever it was, feeling extremely nervous because we name names.
I think that was absolutely critical. I think it's a very good point you've made there, Kevin. The thing would have been pointless, I think, if you couldn't name names. The thing was to expose wrongdoers, if you want to take the most sort of a highly moral ground on that. And you cannot. What was the point in doing that if you couldn't name names? And I think we probably, together, our team, won some battles there in being able to do that. And it took a while, and I think there was a degree of nervousness by the broadcaster. And eventually it turned out all right. And then, of course, when support for the program built, then they stopped worrying about it, I guess.
We play the Fair Go theme. I'm talking to Brian Edwards and Kevin Milne, by the way, both former hosts. And Brian was the creator, co-creator of Fair Go. I played the Fair Go theme earlier. Someone's pointed out that, in fact, that wasn't the original theme. So we've dragged out that one as well. This comes from the first year of the show in 1977, and it also includes Brian's introduction.
And welcome to the final Fair Go for 1977. Over the past year, we've unearthed some major rip-offs and some minor rip-offs, and we've come to our own conclusions about who are the really dishonest groups in our society. But we were more interested to find out who you, the public, felt were the greatest rip-off merchants in New Zealand. We put that question to a number of unsuspecting passers-by in the street.
But I can tell you that the most dishonest people, I think, are council workers.
My own personal opinion is that accountants and lawyers are
probably trade unions.
Yes, I think we could do without them now.
I suppose the quickest that comes to memory could be car dealers.
Or car dealers in some respects. Yes. Mechanics and garages.
Insurance.
Insurance?
Yeah, insurance.
I've never had a bad deal, mainly because I've sort of always steered clear of anybody who might give me a bad deal.
Well, I'm afraid as a tax inspector, I've got to say the taxpayer.
And just as a matter of interest, car dealers topped the poll in that strictly unscientific survey of the country's most dishonest citizens, with the legal profession running a close second.
So how much has changed?
I would say very little has changed, probably. I think life changes very little sometimes in a lot of areas. Insurance, that interested me just hearing that back. That was a big, big issue in those days, I remember. Mm. People were very, very unhappy about that. You were constantly being stopped in the street. I mean, all of us who worked on Fair Go were constantly being stopped in the street by people to tell us things and to air their grievances to you when you were going around. And curiously enough, that was a delightful part of the program.
Interesting to hear your own voice from 44 years ago.
Yes. I think the accent was a bit stronger then. I'm not absolutely sure. Was it the Irish accent? I don't know. I'm not quite sure.
No, I'm not sure either. It's a great voice, great broadcasting voice.
He wasn't a bad broadcaster, actually, Brian, was he, when you think about it? I mentioned my book before. I wrote in my book that I think Brian was the... perhaps along with Paul Holmes, the greatest broadcaster this country's ever had. And that's why I feel it's such a pleasure to be on any show with him.
It's mutual, sunshine. It's obviously mutual, of course.
I think everyone has Fair Go memories. We were talking about the lighthearted moments. I remember watching with Mum at home as you handed out some hokey pokey cartons of ice cream among the audience, and people, you asked the audience to go through them and count the pieces of hokey pokey to see if they would disappear. Does that ring any bells?
Yes, it rings bells, and there's actually a funny end to that story. Well, it's not all that funny, really. We used to have a live audience when we were going at Avalon in the earlier days, and somebody complained that there wasn't as much hokey pokey in New American ice cream as there was Tip Top. And so at the beginning of the show, I asked if people would put their hands up if they wanted to be part of a live experiment during the show. And a couple of elderly folk put their hands up, and I thought, well, I'm not sure about this, but we'll go with it. Yeah. I shouldn't deny the elderly, as I'm now finding out. And so we gave them each a carton of Hokey Pokey, and they were right throughout the half hour to pick out the Hokey Pokey, one of each brand, and see which one had the most. And I can't remember now who won or lost that particular thing, but I do remember 2 days after that program went to air, getting a call from a GP saying, I'm not ringing you guys necessarily to complain, but I think you ought to know that I'm now dealing with two patients, elderly, who have frostbite. And they may remain. They may remain the only people in the world to have ever caught frostbite from having their hands on ice cream for too long.
That's incredible.
That's a true story.
Kevin, you became a master yourself, of course, master broadcaster. But do you recall if Brian had any advice or words of wisdom for you when you arrived at Fair Go in 1982?
Yeah, what he did actually, and it held me in good stead, I think, for the 27 or so years I worked on the show. You didn't have a story simply because someone had breached the rules or broken the law, and if they hadn't done either of those things, it didn't mean that there wasn't a story. It was rather if a business or an individual had caused hurt, then they had to answer for it. Think like a human being rather than like a lawyer or a policeman.
That's great.
And yeah. I think that's affected my journalism, not only Fair Go, but with any journalism I've done. That's what makes it so different.
That's
the
what the viewer's interested in, right, Brian? The viewer's interested in right and wrong and fairness. They're not really interested in the letter of the law.
Yeah, I mean, so the clue to that was simply in the title of the program, Fair Go. And the Fair Go was directed at ordinary people, that ordinary people should receive a fair go. And I've never really thought that New Zealand was full of crooks and dishonest dealers, but there were enough of them, and in fact probably a little bit more than enough, to provide all the information and everything we needed to make the program. And it was a wonderfully satisfying program, of course, to be on. And I'm trying to remember, Kevin may have an idea. Did we ever receive any threats from people, Kevin? Can you remember that or not?
I remember you telling me that you received a threat when you did that extraordinary story before I was anything to do with Fair Go about the...
Services.
Clutch Services.
Yes, yes.
A company up in Auckland. And, well, you tell us about the threat there, Brian.
Well, I'm trying... Let me just...
Trying to remember.
Try and remember that. Well, the situation was that you took your car in to have your clutch fixed. And rather than actually fixing your clutch, they took the clutch out, they painted it black, and then they put it back again. They had contributed something, in terms of colour at least. That wasn't really the issue. The issue was that when you got your car back and drove it, and the clutch failed left, right and centre, if you complained about it, they started threatening you. They were real threats. You know, they were, we'll come and see you, we'll come and visit you. That was scary stuff. But it was, of course, it was manna from heaven for us running a program because we were able to get stuck into that in a very real sense. And in the end, the purpose of the program was the protection of people and providing in everyday life and in their dealings with businesses and also holding to account, obviously, the dealers that didn't deal fairly with their clients.
I remember that story so well as a viewer. Clutch Services.
Yes.
And I think it actually went over two different programs for one reason or another.
Yes.
And I remember you sitting next, doing the live interview, sitting next to one of these guys, or maybe one on either side of you. And I was sitting back thinking, if you get any cheekier to these guys, this is going to turn into a fight. I genuinely thought that. It was absolutely riveting. I was scared for you.
Well, I appreciate that very much. But, of course, you were protected by the listening audience. And that was the thing about it all, by your viewers. I think you'd have been very foolish if you had been one of the crims, if you want to call them that, we were dealing with. To have done anything, it was in any way sort of nasty.
But did you get nervous, Brian?
I think the answer. What you mean, nervous about
confrontational interviews, particularly with bad sorts?
No, I don't think so.
No, I think you loved them.
I think you're right. I mean, you see, you were protected. You were protected because you had this massive audience, as the two of us know. That was your protection. You would have been crazy to do anything to take some sort of revenge on anyone involved in the Fair Go program because it had this enormous audience of absolute fans. The people who would have been harmed most by that would have been the people who had threatened you in some way, by far.
How about you? Actually, well, let's play a clip of Kevin and then we'll ask him the same question. This is thanks to the collection from the team at NZ On Screen, and it's Kevin Milne in 2007 telling the story of a dodgy concreter.
We're dealing with four separate complaints from Tennyson Street here in Upper Hutt. And the extraordinary thing about this story is that it mirrors exactly a story that we told on Fair Go out of Auckland in 1990. Not only are the issues the same, but the tradesman behind those issues is the same bloke.
Inele Fangiafino, he usually calls himself Henry, is well known in the Pacific. Since 1978, he's made several sorties from his home in Tonga to Honolulu, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Vancouver, Sydney, and finally Auckland. In most of those cities, Henry ran the same scam. He'd take thousands of dollars in advance for landscaping work. Then he'd fly home to Tonga with the money.
Mm-hmm. So that was part one, and we have some audio of you, Kevin, confronting the dodgy concreter. And this will give viewers a bit of a taste of what a confrontation sounded like.
Well, a bit of a surprise. We've been filming this driveway, but I've just heard that Enele has turned up at one of the other people's houses that he owes money to. So we're going to dash off, try and catch him. Come with us. Hello. Enele.
Oh.
Kevin Milne here from Fair Go Program.
Sorry, right. Kevin.
I've seen you before on television. You were on our program in 1990, is that correct?
Yes.
And we've got exactly the same problem with a whole lot more people.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah, what's going on?
It's all right.
What do you mean it's all right? It might be all right for you, but it's not all right for all these people.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Does it take you back?
Yeah, it does take me back. He was actually not a particularly scary character, and he was one of the, perhaps the only person that after a story was told to get out of New Zealand. He had to go back to the Tonga or Pacific Samoa, I can't remember now, because he was an overstayer.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was
so what was your approach, Kevin? Did you have a sort of a philosophy or an approach when you walked up to someone like that?
No, not really. I wasn't particularly scared either. Like Brian, I had a cameraman right behind. As long as the camera was rolling, I felt pretty safe. The only thing that worried me were dogs. Sometimes you'd knock on a door and the dog would arrive first. You could hear it on the inside scratching away on the wall. I mean, on the door, on the wood. And you'd be thinking, this guy only needs to open the door and I'm a goner if he doesn't call his dog in. And it never happened. I never got actually hurt by a dog, but I worried far more about dogs than I did people. I always could argue, I felt I could argue my way out of any sort of confrontation, but you can't with a dog, can you?
I find this disappointing about you, you know, actually, Kevin. It's probably a good time to bring this up now because I've never mentioned it to you before. You should have interviewed the dog. Come on.
That's right.
No, too chicken shit to do that, really. Never mind.
There was one time, actually, when I did probably the biggest investigation I did, which was against a company called Ron West Motors in Auckland. And I set myself up in a hotel room up in Auckland so that I could interview a whole lot of people there. And I went down to pick up a guy, and one of the guys in the company was a very, very large guy called, he was known as Big John. and Big John had a bit of background. And I went down to pick up the next person I was interviewed, and there was this great big guy sitting there, and I couldn't think that I'd arranged to meet him, but he said, I'll come up to your room. And we found ourselves in the lift together, and I said, who are you? And he gave me a name, and I thought he was making that up. So I actually stopped the lift and told him if he wouldn't mind, we were getting out and going back down again.
Right.
And that's what we did. I thought if I get into the room with him, he's just going to clean me up and head off. He was a huge, big brute of a man.
Yeah, so he's sort of doing kind of informal security for someone, was he?
As it turned out, I had totally the wrong guy. The guy was actually a totally legit member of the Licensed Motor Vehicle Dealers Institute, and he had come to talk to me about the story. And he was equally large as the guy that I was afraid of, but I thought it was the guy lying. And but that was a real scaredy moment where I just wanted to get out of there.
Yeah, you mentioned you were up in Auckland. Was Was it filmed in Wellington? It was, at Avalon.
Yes, right? filmed in
Avalon, yes.
Still filmed there? Or did they move up to Auckland at some point?
Moved to Auckland about 98, yes, I think it was.
Yeah.
So about half its life has now been in Auckland.
Okay, and they lost the studio audience along the way?
Yeah, they lost the studio audience just before we moved up to Auckland.
Do you remember why?
It was considered that actually you could put together a tidier program. You could reshoot. You know all about the filming things. You know, you could pre-shoot stuff and all that sort of stuff. And that the audience, while you'd miss the audience a little bit, you'd gain greater advantage in the studio. You'd have a wonderful studio setup.
Yeah, and was that the case?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was. Although I always feel now that it'd be great to have a live show back on that that show. You know, it would be brilliant.
Add something to your performance, doesn't
it? Yeah,
it
does, absolutely. And I never disliked the audience. I always liked the audience. Of course, I had a massively bigger ego than Kevin, by a bit. I liked the audience. I thought that was a good thing. And I think the viewer liked the audience as well. Unconsciously, perhaps, but I mean, it did add a flavour to what was going on, you know. So you'd get applause when a good point was made, or when one of your people you were interviewing made a good point.
You would be able to feel it during an interview.
You could feel it very much indeed. One of the interesting things about it was that how quickly all of us working on that programme became extraordinarily famous. So that too, and you find this as you went around town, as you were walking somewhere. Kevin, I remember, used to go for enormously long walks, and he had a little calculator, and he would use this to count the number of people who recognized him. He was otherwise quite modest.
The fingers on one hand was enough, really.
Yeah, that's right. And so there was a joy in working on that program, simply from the response you got from people in the street, and in addition to any fan mail or anything else you might get. It was actually quite difficult to go for a walk if you were one of the people who worked on Fair Go, because you'd be stopped everywhere with people telling you how much they liked the show.
Any favourite co-presenters you each want to mention?
None.
I think that we have to mention Philip Alpers.
Of course we do. Yes.
He brought a whole hardness. He turned the show slightly, actually. From up to that point, it had been very like That's Life in Britain, you know, with Esther Anson that Brian's referred to. But I think he turned it much more into a current affairs program with serious investigations and, you know, some huge investigations. The Toyota rust. Remember when we used to get cars, or Jesse, you may be too young for this, but we used to get our cars sent over from Japan, second-hand cars that come over on boats, and they'd sit on in big car, not car yards, but big yards on the waterfront for months and months before they ever went out to the public. And so as a result, they always used to rust. Nobody really knew why until Brian got into this. And it turned out that the companies, and mainly Toyota and Mazda, had quite happily left these cars sitting in a situation where eventually they'd look quite good when you bought them, but eventually they'd rust. Yeah. And those companies had to pay millions of dollars out to repair them in the end.
Well, we're talking about favourite stories. Is there a story, Kevin, about a house built over a boundary?
Yeah, that was quite a... Well, that was when I think it was another cock-up on my part. one of the things about, you know, these stories is that you had to try and explain boring things and make them interesting.
Oh, but you did the boring things so well.
That's right. I made interesting stories boring.
No, you didn't.
But on this particular occasion, that someone discovered that their house was actually built over the boundary line with their neighbours.
Oh, yes.
And to show where the boundary line went, I went out and got what some idiot described to me as kindergarten paint, finger paint. You know, you could wash it off straight away. And I took it there and painted this line up the side of his house, right across his roof and down the other side. And it was a sort of a bright orange, like a racing stripe.
Yeah.
And And we got it on there, and then we did all the filming about that, then had a bite of lunch with them and what have you. And then when we went afterwards to wash it off, none of it would come off.
Oh,
and so that when I said goodbye to these guys that day, you know, they still had the problem. Well, this house was still over the boundary line, but now they had a bright orange racing stripe showing the world of the problem that they had.
Yeah.
We had to get the set designers in Dunedin, Christchurch, to come in and redo the whole house.
I wanted to mention the Ad Awards. When did they come about, and were they an immediate hit? Do either of you recall?
But you can say when they came about, because I don't have a memory anymore.
Yeah.
And then we'll just talk about whether they became a hit.
Yeah, well, they were certainly in your day, weren't they, Brian?
They were in my day, yes.
They started off in your day, and what were they called? They were given some the Fantastic Flop Awards. Was that what we called them then?
I don't think so.
Oh,
sorry.
Well, we had big trophies that were a large F.
Yes.
And I thought that that stood for Fantastic Flops, and maybe it stood for something else entirely different.
But anyway, someone had the idea of doing it once a year and rewarding the good ads and marking the bad ads. Is that the idea?
Just to help Brian along on this one, because it wasn't just ads. It started off as a program where, and this is typical Brian, He said, I know we work for NZBC or whatever, but we're going to invite people to write in and vote for what they think of their best and worst TV programs. And that was part of the show. So it was a half an hour show, but first quarter of hour was your best and worst programs.
Yeah.
And then the second bit was the ads. Do you remember that, Brian?
Yeah, well, what's known as biting the hand that feeds you.
Yes, that's right.
I can see why that part of the show may have quietly been discontinued.
Possibly, yes.
I'll tell you why, because I remember this fairly clearly. Every year, Tukariri was voted worst program.
Yeah.
And there was this rather most unsavoury sort of element of people
New Zealand
voting
in the early 80s.
And and Brian thought, well, this was supposed to be fun. You know, let's just ditch it and we'll do the whole show with ads.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point you've just made, because I think the humour on the programme on Fair Go was a very significant and very important part of it. I think if you had a stodgy half hour, a very heavy, very serious material, including, of course, some people really getting done over well and truly by you and me and one or two other people, Kev.
Yeah.
That would not have been, in the end, I think that would have gone under. But the humorous elements and the comedy which we had in the show, I think, were very important in keeping it running for so long.
It's funny you mentioned Philip Alpers, because when I picture, you talk about him bringing a hard edge, but when I picture him, is it strange that I picture him in quite a wide-brimmed hat?
Yeah, no, it's not strange, yes.
What was that all about?
You'll have to answer that, Kit.
Oh, well, he never got the idea that, you know, if you were going to do serious journalism, you had to look serious.
Yeah.
And which I loved about him, really. So he used to turn up in straight white suits, knowing that he was going to be falling into a big muddy puddle. And he'd have this range of fedoras and bright. This was actually a tradition that had been carried on from earlier, when you had these wonderful people like Hugo Manson, for example. When he was a reporter on the program, he used to turn up in sort of boating jackets and all sorts of colourful gear. You had the wonderful Sharon...
Fyfe.
Judith Fyfe, who would turn up in what would now look just ordinary jewellery, probably, but back then had long, round, huge earrings and big spectacle frames that were oversized, and everybody just... I said earlier that people would sometimes turn on just to watch the funny stuff. I'm sure a lot of people just turned on just to see Judith Fyfe, what she was wearing that night.
Should also mention Kerry McIver, or Kerry Woodham, as she was at the time, Carol Hirschfeld, Gordon Harcourt, Ali Moore, and I've been talking to Kevin Milne and Brian Edwards about Fair Go. Can I ask you, just to finish, Brian, where does Fair Go rank among the many things that you've done in your broadcasting career, and how do you remember it?
getting quite moved by Kevin there. He's a very moving person. Where does it rank in my career? Well, it's right up the top there somewhere, really. And part of the reason for that is, I think, the response that you got from the public. I have been somewhat vain in my lifetime, and sometimes I would go for a walk down Lambton Quay or wherever it might be. And it might be to go and get some sausages, but it might be just to wait to see how many people would come over and talk to me or tell me how great I was. This is television, mind you. This is how we think. It ranks in my life as one of the most extraordinary things, partly for the wonderful people I worked with, one of whom is on the other end of the line here, and partly for the reception you got. He will tell you this. You were hero worshipped after a while. Everyone on that team, everyone on that crew got hero worshipped after a while. And so if you had a bad day, if things were really not working out very well, you know, if the cat had pooed on the carpet, you could go for a walk and you would be stopped and stopped and stopped and stopped. And it was absolutely lovely.
You said you wanted to be famous, but in fact, the truth is you want to be famous for doing something good, right?
No, I wanted to be famous.
Kevin, what was it, 22 years?
27, I think.
27 years, yeah.
Yeah, it took me about 27 years to get about a quarter as famous as Brian did in 7 on the program.
Sorry, can I interrupt you?
Yes.
You mean you're now at that point?
Any final thoughts on the show from your perspective, Kevin?
I hope it continues, I hope that the budgets don't get cut anymore. It's an important show for the whole of New Zealand. You know, there can't be another country where someone can walk into a store and say, "If you don't sort this out, I'm ringing Fair Go," and everybody knows what the hell you mean.
Yes.
And as a final point from me too, I think it's remarkable. When you've said to Brian, you know, what part did Fair Go play, when you consider that he was the leading current affairs interviewer in this country for years, he did Fair Go for years, he did any number of other things, and then he went to radio and set up the Saturday morning show that Kim Hill now runs, an extraordinary broadcaster and the best broadcaster I think this country's ever seen.
Thank you. The check is in the mail.
And thank you each for your service to New Zealand Broadcasting and for being so generous with your time today, Brian Edwards and Kevin Milne.
Thank you very much.
Cheers to you both.